From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight with our split show is the Sovereign Citizen Movement, an extremist anti-government group. You decide. Happy birthday, by the way, to Radio's Fred Vabi from his friends at the National Radio Club. Here's what's happening. NASA satellite data from years 2000 through 2011 show the Earth's atmosphere is allowing far more heat to be released into space than alarmist computer models have predicted. According to a new study in the science journal Remote Sensing, the study indicates far less future global warming will occur than the United Nations computer models have predicted, and supports prior studies indicating increases in atmospheric carbon dioxide trap far less heat than some claim. In a moment, the study's co-author, Dr. Roy Spencer, a principal research scientist at the University of Alabama, joins us. Austin, Texas. When I was there, and I've been there a couple times, speaking at our affiliate, KLBJ, in their Talk Fest, the folks there took me on a tour of Austin, Texas, great city, but they showed me a bridge, a historic bridge in downtown Austin, where underneath it, there are 1.5 million bats stuck under the bridge. Well, listen to this story. These 1.5 million bats that live under the bridge in downtown Austin, the historic Texas drought, is now making them hungrier than ever. And that's bad news for the bats in the world's largest urban bat colony. The drought has killed off crops in Texas that in turn has killed off those pests that the Mexican free-tailed bats consider dinner. That means they have to leave home earlier than usual each night to find nourishment, and they are flying all over the place each night. They stream from under a bridge by the hundreds of thousands in a black cloud so large that it shows up on local weather radar. Comet Elenin will be the closest to the sun in early September of this year at a distance of about 40 to 45 million miles. It will be the closest to Earth on October 16th at a distance of about 21 million miles. But astronomers say there's no reason to think that the comet is any different from a normal comet. Dan Durd, a planetary scientist with us. Dan, what do you think? Any danger from this comet or not?
Hey, George. No, actually, you said it pretty well. It's, you know, from our point of view, it's, I hate to say it, but it's just another comet. Not to mean it's not interesting to us, but it's we've seen this before, so to speak.
Why do so many people pinpoint this comet as a potential
I don't
comet?
Know. You know, no? It really is puzzling to us why certain stories like this one get picked out. It really is. It's just another long-period comet that's wandered through our inner solar, or is going to be wandering through our inner solar system. There have been bigger ones in the past, brighter ones in the past. This one's relatively small. It's only a couple miles across, and that's a relatively, you know, far distance too. Other comets have come even closer. So it's just another comet.
We have more space objects to worry about other than this comet, then.
Oh, absolutely. There are asteroids passing, inside of our moon's orbit, very close to us all the time, once a month or so. Other near-Earth asteroids to worry about. The comets are really long-period comets like this one are only about a percent of the total impact hazard that the Earth has to worry about. So it'll be a interesting view for amateur astronomers, but other than that, not much to this one.
All right, good. We're safe. Thanks, Daniel. Dan was, by the way, my very first Coast to Coast guest back on April 28th, 2001. The world's largest network of radio telescopes is ready to begin phase one of operations in northern Chile. The complex, under construction for over a decade, received the 16th of 66 total antennas, and that's enough to begin its first science observations, an important milestone for the project. When it reaches full operational capacity, it will have a resolution 10 times greater than the Hubble Space Telescope. Time is running out on the budget. A vote on a Republican bill to raise the U.S. debt ceiling, cut spending, and avert default has been delayed now in the face of conservative resistance. House Speaker John Boehner and the Republican leaders struggling to convince rank-and-file lawmakers to vote on this bill. This plan, however, is almost certain to fail in the Democratic-led Senate, and the White House has warned of a veto anyway. Congress must raise the debt limit by a deadline of next Tuesday. Gerald Celente, founder and director of the Trends Research Institute. Gerald, they're going to take this thing right down to the end, aren't they?
Oh, yes, they are. This is what the government does. It's the economic version of military war kind of fear and hysteria. This is what they do, George. They get the people all excited, and then they do what they want to do. A trillion here, a trillion there. None of this is going to make any difference. The die is set, and whether or not deal or no deal, default or no default, we're still looking at the greatest depressions underway. None of this is going to make one bit of difference.
And yet, they're going to try to convince us that they've saved us all, aren't they, Jerry?
Exactly. Just like TSA has saved us all and Homeland Security saved us all. They're saving us again. They're not saving anybody. They're not saving anything. This Ponzi scheme is collapsing, and it's going global. The Europeans are facing the same problem. They just term it differently.
What's new with TrendsResearch.com?
Oh, our Trends Journal just came out, the Summit Trends Journal, and I have to say, it's the global game changer, direct democracy, and that's what this is all about. Just as you see these cavalcades of clowns appearing on TV every day that call themselves politicians, it's time to put the vote in the hands of the people. Let the people vote.
You got it. Thanks, Gerald. An American Airlines pilot was beaten as he tried to escort two belligerent brothers, Jonathan and Luis Baez, off a flight from Miami to San Francisco. According to the arrest report, the altercation began when the flight was taxiing on the runway and a flight attendant noticed that the 27-year-old Jonathan Baez was asleep and not wearing his seatbelt. The attendant attempted to wake him up, but he was unresponsive and appeared to be intoxicated or heavily medicated. The pilot was alerted of the situation, turned the plane around, heading back to the gate. Baez finally awoke and was told that he would not be permitted to continue on the overnight flight given his condition. As Jonathan was being escorted from the plane by the flight attendant and the pilot, his 29-year-old brother Luis, who was also on the flight, decided to disembark as well. The brothers are from Las Piedras, Puerto Rico. The pilot stayed behind as both men were escorted off the plane. But somehow Jonathan returned, striking the pilot in the face with his fist, and another flight attendant tried to intervene but was hit in the shoulder. Then both men began beating the pilot with their fists, striking his chest and chasing him into the terminal where they continued to assault him. The men were eventually detained by flight crew members and passengers on the flight, heroes indeed. The pilot sustained facial bruising and lacerations, as well as blurred vision. Up next, Dr. Roy Spencer joins us as we talk about new NASA satellite data that is contradicting global warming climate models. Dr. Roy Spencer next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. As I was saying, NASA satellite data from the years 2000 through 2011 show the Earth's atmosphere is allowing far more heat to be released into space than computer models are predicting. And the study is now indicating far less future global warming will occur than the United Nations computer models have predicted. Now, the study's co-author, Dr. Roy Spencer, has been on the program before, a principal research scientist at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, and also a U.S. science team leader for the Advanced Microwave Scanning Radiometer flying on NASA's Aqua satellite, reports that the worldwide data from the satellite contradict the multiple assumptions fed into the computer models. Here's Dr. Roy Spencer back on Coast to Coast. This is an interesting study, Roy. How are you?
Good, George. How you doing?
Good, good. Tell me more about it.
Well, basically what we did was we took over 10 years of data from one of our best NASA satellites to examine how the Earth gains and loses radiant energy when it warms up and cools down. For instance, when there's a warm El Nino year. We looked at how much energy the Earth loses in terms of reflected sunlight and emitted infrared radiation. Those are the two flows of energy which basically keep the Earth at about the same temperature. You know, the temperature of anything is related to a balance between energy gain and energy loss. And just like a pot of water on the stove, gaining energy from the stove and then losing energy to its surroundings, the Earth gains energy from the sun and then loses energy to space with infrared radiation. And so anyway, we've got satellites up there, two of them now, that can pretty accurately measure the total amount of energy the Earth receives and how much energy the Earth loses to outer space. And what we found is that when the Earth warms up, say during an El Nino year, that it loses, it has a natural cooling mechanism that, and it ends up losing a lot more energy to outer space when it's warm, compared to computerized climate models, the models that predict so much global warming for our future. So there's a major disconnect between what nature is telling us of how the climate system really works versus how these computer models work that are predicting a lot of global warming for our future.
Roy, how did these United Nations computer models show that the heat would stay in as much as they did?
Okay, this is what we call feedbacks. Okay, if there's something that causes the Earth to warm, let's say you turn this sun up by 1%.
Okay.
Or let's say you trap the infrared radiation by 1%, which is supposedly what CO2 does. The amount of CO2 we've added to the atmosphere traps more infrared radiation and slightly reduces the Earth's ability to cool to outer space. Well, everyone pretty much agrees that extra CO2 causes a small warming influence. Where we disagree is how the climate system responds in terms of feedbacks, particularly cloud feedbacks. As the Earth warms, do clouds dissipate and let more sunlight in, thereby enhancing the warming? That would be a positive feedback. Or do clouds increase, act as a sun shield, and actually reduce the warming? The IPCC models, these United Nations-sponsored climate models, all predict that clouds will change in such a way to amplify the warming. But the satellite data suggests that clouds change in such a way that it reduces the warming. So this is totally opposite to the way those models operate in the way that clouds behave, at least for climate change.
Are the UN researchers, those who fed the data into the computers and came up with the models, are they aware of this study, your work?
Yes, they're increasingly aware of the work that we've been doing because we've been publishing work like this for the last few years now. Most of them tend to just ignore us. Some of them have actually taken us on. Very few actually understand the work because, believe it or not, even though scientists are supposed to be objective, when scientists are sure that they're right, seldom will scientists look at published papers that disagree with their worldview of how things work. But our work is getting increasingly difficult to ignore. And in fact, this paper that we just had published this week, which is why I'm talking to you right now, was in answer to one of the United Nations, I'll call them United Nations-affiliated researchers, who claimed that our work was bogus and mm-hmm. it didn't matter, and so we had to respond with this publication to further prove our case.
Are you changing the minds of any of those UN researchers, Roy?
It's hard to tell. I've had a couple of them contact me privately to better understand what I'm talking about. I know for a fact that at least a couple of them do understand what I'm talking about and consider my view of things, and I'm not the only one out there. There's a handful of us out there doing this kind of research. Think that what we're finding is indeed possibly the way the climate system works. But unfortunately, these researchers do not speak out publicly. They have too much to lose by going against the scientific consensus on global warming. And that's why you usually only hear about this stuff from politicians, from Al Gore, from the media, pundits, people that tend to exaggerate the certainty of global warming science. And the scientists tend to stay relatively silent on the issue.
Roy, in the beginning, when the talk of global warming was just starting, what were your views? How did you perceive all of this?
Well, that's an interesting question, George. I think I've always viewed nature as being fairly resilient, robust. And that is sort of a worldview, based on the way I see nature work.
Sure.
It that view has guided my research. And you might think, well, that's kind of a biased thing for a scientific researcher. Well, it turns out that all scientific researchers, including those who think the Earth is very fragile, what they do is they analyze data that they get with those blinders on, with, you know, with those, you know, warm-colored glasses on. They view the Earth as fragile, and so they interpret the data in such a way that reinforces what they already believe, basically. And you might wonder, well, don't the data tell you? And no, the data don't tell you. I try to explain to people that even if we had perfect measurements, which we don't, if we had perfect measurements of the climate system every day over the whole Earth, that scientists could still come to totally opposite conclusions about how the climate system works in terms of cause and effect. The measurements are the easy part. Figuring out what those measurements mean in terms of cause and effect, that's the hard part. And that's true in a lot of areas of science.
Roy, I've talked to a couple of people on the show, scientists, who believe we might be in the early stages of a mini ice age. What do you think?
Well, just about anything is possible. From everything I've looked at, I can't see how we're going to cool in the next, say, 10 to 20 to 30 years. I still believe, as do the UN scientists, that adding CO2 is a net warming effect. I just don't think it's as big a warming effect as they think it is.
Right.
Now, could there be natural cooling processes that overcome that? It's possible, but that's in the realm of things we don't understand about the climate system. And I'm perfectly willing to admit there's probably some big surprises left for us in the climate system. And if it doesn't start warming again, you know, it really hasn't warmed in the last 8 or 10 years, which everyone agrees is sort of a mystery. If it doesn't start warming again in the next 5 or so years, it's going to be really hard for global warming theory to survive, because this is the time at which we should be seeing maximum warming. In a sense, this is the point at which the stove is turned up the most with the extra CO2 we've put in the atmosphere. But it stopped warming for some reason.
Well, now, a number of states would say to you today, we're cooking here. You know, we've had 65 deaths nationwide. This is a hot, hot summer. Isn't that warming, they would say?
Yeah, the trouble is that summers do get hot. Some are hotter than others. I remember 1980, and that's before global warming really could have been the cause. You know, man-made
right.
Global warming could have been the cause. That was much more exceptional in terms of warmth. Texas, you know, went through months of daily temperatures above 100 degrees. You know, not just strings of weeks. They went through months. A few records were broken this year. Excuse me. You know, what's interesting is that people forget about the cold weather records that were broken. For instance, with the recent warm weather, if you look on Wikipedia, there's a claim out there that Connecticut broke its all-time high temperature record about a week ago.
Right, right.
Turns out it's wrong. The numbers that somebody stuck out there on this Wikipedia page are 10 degrees too warm. Connecticut, in fact, no states broke their all-time record highs. But back in February, Oklahoma broke its all-time record low in February at 31 degrees below zero in one town in Oklahoma.
It's a cyclical planet, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I think it is. And people have short memories, and they think that just because something is exceptional in their lifetime or in their experience, that somehow it's never happened before, which is ridiculous.
Roy, when we come back in just a moment, you have a book out called Fundonomics. That's kind of different, but in light of what's going on all over this country with the debt crisis, I want to get your take on this and see where it might be taking us, all right?
All right.
We'll be doing that. Dr. Roy Spencer's website linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Some of his other works, The Great Global Warming Blunder, Climate Confusion. We're talking to him about this study about the Earth releasing a little more heat into space than some UN computer models have predicted. And when we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM, we'll get his take on just what's going on economically, and that affects all of us. and you know that. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Dr. Roy Spencer as we talk about his latest study that regards the Earth sending out more heat into space than predicted by UN models. And then we'll also talk about his new work called Fundonomics. That's right. Get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. Roy, though you're a research scientist, you still have an understanding of economics. You've written a book called Fundonomics. Tell me about this.
I've always had a really strong interest in basic economics, and it's partly because it amazes me how little most people know about basic economics principles. So anyway, it's something that I've been I've been writing about it in my first book, Climate Confusion. I had a chapter on basic economics, which a lot of people told me was their favorite chapter in the book, even though the book was about global warming. I've got a book out there, a short pamphlet called The Bad Science and Bad Policy of Obama's Global Warming Agenda. This book, my most recent one, Fundonomics, very short, it's a big picture examination of what energizes the free market. What I've done here is I've tried to make a simple, almost a pamphlet type book that I think is the simplest explanation of how the free market works and why a lot of the things that we hear about in terms of the government meddling in the economy, trying to make things better, actually makes things worse. It's been a really fun exercise for me. It's partly been to reduce my frustration after listening to politicians.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
You know, to keep me from throwing bottles at the TV set whenever I hear some of the ridiculous things that politicians say about how they're going to help the economy.
I'm not sure they know.
I think a lot of them don't know. I think a lot of them are just clueless about basic economics. I think some of them do know, and they just don't care. But, you know, it's like global warming. You know, you really don't know what's in the hearts and minds of some of these people. They spout one thing publicly, but you really don't know what they believe in their hearts.
You know, home prices continue to drop, Roy. Foreclosures continue to go up. People are concerned. Unemployment's still high. Those who work are doing okay. Those who aren't doing okay. What's going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years, in your opinion?
Well, of course, predicting the future is always the hardest thing to do for climate or for economics, right? I mean, I've had economists contact me and say, you know, your field is a lot like ours. We make a lot of predictions, and we're usually wrong. So, you know, when you ask me for an economics prediction, it's worth about as much as my climate predictions or anybody else's climate predictions. But to get to your question, what's going to happen, I don't know. To keep our country from eventually falling into economic collapse, it's going to take some really hard decisions. There's too many people that depend too much on government, or I should say too much on their neighbors, since that's where the wealth comes from that's given to them, for handouts. And, you know, we've now reached this, 40% discrepancy between what the government brings in and what it spends. And the discrepancy is growing. This deficit is growing year by year, and they're just talking about they can't even, Congress and the president can't even make even minor, you know, cutbacks without a lot of wailing and whining, not only from the public, but from politicians that depend on the power that they get from giving out all of this money. I just really fear we're headed for some sort of collapse like Argentina experienced around 2001.
And you know, we might have to start all over again.
It becomes a third world country.
Yeah, at least short term. I mean, this country has one thing that they're not talking about, and that is it does have huge cash flow from taxpayers and taxes and other sources. Why can't they just develop some kind of program, Roy, where they say, okay, we're going to extend the debt for now because we don't want to default on anything, and over a 20 or 25-year period, we're going to start reducing the budget every year in a smaller increment so not to hurt or affect the economy, but we're going to cut things because they have to be cut. That would include, of course, if we weren't in Afghanistan or Iraq, God knows how much we'd be saving there. But why don't they do something like that? To me, that sounds sensible.
Well, George, I totally agree. I think that is probably the only sensible way out of this. You can't fix the problem overnight. There's no way you can just suddenly cut 40% out of the federal budget.
Can't do it.
You're going to have to chisel away at it, whittle away at it over a period of many years. I think what you're talking about is exactly what needs to be done. It remains to see whether that is what's done, though. You mentioned cash flow. In my book, Fundonomics, one of the first things I point out is that money is not wealth. You know, that's one of the things that we got to get away from thinking about is the perception that money is wealth. Money is just an easy means of exchange, a convenient means of exchange of goods and services between people. They're like, you know, universally redeemable IOUs. What really matters for prosperity is people doing stuff for each other that other people need. And that's the basic theme of the book, Fundonomics, is prosperity is achieved through people having the freedom to do as much as they can, to make as much stuff as they can for other people that other people want and need. That's what makes a prosperous country. Money is really irrelevant to it. And, you know, when the government starts printing more money, all it does is reduce the value of the rest of the money in circulation. It's the same thing as raising taxes or coming and taking your stuff away from you. It has the same effect.
I'm not an economist, but we've just talked about something that could sensibly work. Why aren't they thinking about that in Washington?
Well, I think some of them are. Boehner sometimes talks about his plan as sort of being a first step. I'm just kind of skeptical about politicians following through. You know, we've seen so many cases where the public gets upset over something, Washington responds with some sort of plan, and then everyone sort of forgets about it, and nothing happens. And I'm just fearful that nothing will happen in time for us to not get downgraded. I don't see how that's not going to happen with the debt load we've got now.
Right.
Interest rates will rise.
It should have been. The downgrade should have happened years ago, honestly.
Oh, I agree. I'm afraid we've started down a slippery slope, and it's going to be hard to claw our way back up again. I hate to sound pessimistic, but especially since, you know, we've historically, we have the creativity and the freedom to do such great things in this country, and we're throwing it away.
Here's my concern too, Roy. I've always been aware of the differences between the haves and the have-nots. Those of us who are working, those who are unfortunate and can't, or they're not able to, or they don't have a job. If that gap continues to widen, as it is, every day, every month, every year, there's going to be a problem. You know, the things that we've been seeing in the Middle East over the past several months are going to be nothing compared to what happens here when Americans are truly pushed to the wall, to the brink.
Well, I agree. And unfortunately, that hurts the debate because people point to that gap, that widening gap between the rich and the poor, and they say, oh, look, this is evidence that capitalism doesn't work. Well, no, it's evidence that we've gotten away from capitalism. That's one of the things I show in my book, Fundonomics, that I show data from around the world that shows the greater freedom a people have in their country, the greater economic freedom they have, the more prosperous the whole country is, not just the wealthy, but even the poorest in the country. And that's something that we could always brag about is, you know, we had some of the richest poor countries or some of the richest poor people in the world in our country. And the other thing I discuss is that we need that disparity between rich and poor. I don't want to call it an evil, but it's necessary in order for there to be that disparity, because without that disparity, there is no motivation for those with great ideas and great energies, the entrepreneurs, to take the risk of going out and creating something new that will raise the standard of living of everyone.
Well, I agree with that, but I don't think that gap can be too wide.
No, I agree, but my original point was I think it has widened because the economy is hurting. And when the economy goes downhill, when we have economic troubles, it is the poor that are hurt first.
Yes.
Okay, that's
absolutely
the way it works out. But if you want to help them, help the whole economy. And the only way to help the whole economy is to allow businesses to grow, because they're the ones that hire the poor people.
Well, then the middle class gets eroded away as well. They get the second line of getting hit before the folks who are making a lot of money or have good careers or, you know, have been lucky enough.
Well, you know, to the extent that we have free exchange of goods and services, in other words, where people come to their own decisions about what they're going to pay for stuff, what they're going to buy, you know, when you buy one thing versus another thing, you decide to spend your money on one thing versus another thing, you're voting, you're saying, I value that more than the money I have and more than the money, than what something else that money could have bought. So I'm a big fan of freedom. And then wherever the chips may fall in terms of how many poor people or middle class there are, that is up to individuals to decide for themselves. All I know is that if you meddle with freedom, you hurt prosperity as a whole. We're always going to have the poor with us. There's no way around that. And one of the things I really hit on is one of the things that really hurts us, especially the poor, is the inefficiencies of government. I don't go into, you know, what government should be doing constitutionally. You know, that's sort of a constitutional question. What I talk about is the reasons why government is so inefficient. It's because the incentives for government workers and public employees and politicians is totally opposite to the incentives that exist in the free market. And as a result, there's huge inefficiencies, huge waste. And I argue that, you know, welfare and everything else should be handled by private organizations that compete with each other, you know, that tell the public, hey, if you send your charitable dollars our way, we will make sure that 95% of it gets to the people. So part of the problem with the poor is actually the fault of government.
I've heard so many people who have, you know, worked for small businesses, Roy, that go under because the ownership rapes and robs and pillages the company, you know, takes too much money out of it, and all of a sudden the company folds. It can't sustain a slow period. The employees are the ones that get the short end of the stick. Is that what they did here, where people just were, they were all asleep at the wheel? I mean, the Republican administration that handed it off to a Democratic administration, they both screwed up, didn't they?
Yes, and you've brought up a good point, George. This is sort of a recent development in our country's history. You know, in recent decades, it seems like there has been more concern on the part of business owners, CEOs, you know, the executives in corporations, to where they're more interested in the short-term gain of their own gain than the long-term health of the company. And obviously, that's not good for any of us when that happens. And that's another dynamic that's going on that's hurting us. And of course, it's going on in Washington, as you're alluding to. It's going on in Washington more than it used to. You know, we only used to think of as politicians as only being out for themselves, right? Well, now, unfortunately, we've got too many people in private industry that have been looking out only for themselves, and as a result, you know, they take the wealth and the company goes under, and then you've got thousands or tens of thousands of workers that are out of work.
I'm hopeful that at least by Tuesday they're going to strike some kind of a deal temporarily. It's not going to fix the problem by any means, and I don't think anybody will come up with anything close to what we've been talking about tonight, but my guess is they're gonna do something. How about you?
Well, they have to do something. You know, obviously the debt ceiling is going to have to be raised. There's just simply no way that we can suddenly cut 40% out of the budget. Like you said, the only way out of this without killing the economy is to work on it a little bit. You know, commit to working on it a little bit year after year over a period of 10 or
right.
20 years.
And stick to it.
Yeah, right. I it seems like we only react as a people when things get really bad. And I'm increasingly fearful that we're going to have to turn into another Argentina before people realize how bad it is. And at that point, it's too late. Then we have to rebuild from the beginning, you know. And I hope that doesn't happen.
You know, I've got grandchildren. I don't know about you, Roy, but I wanted to make sure that this country is so sustainable for them. And, I, you know, in a crystal ball, you look ahead at the future. And if it continues going down the path it's going, there's not going to be much for them, is there?
Yeah, I worry about the same thing, too, George. I've got my first grandchild on the way now, and I don't even like to think about it. Hopefully it'll be a new set of problems in another 20 years, and we'll be wrong, and things will get fixed. But, man, it, as of right now, it's just not looking that good.
You're going to love the little grandchild. I mean,
that's what I hear.
Oh, my gosh. We raised one who's 17 now, and then the others, of course, I see when I can. But you're going to love them. And the greatest part about being a grandparent, Roy, you can always say to the daughter or your son, here, take them back now.
Yeah, I hear that's one of the greatest things about being a grandparent as opposed to being a parent.
It is not easy being a parent. Not then and definitely not now. It really isn't. What would you recommend to people? If you were in Washington right now, aside from some of the things we've just talked about, and they said, okay, look, we're listening to you now about climate change. What are you going to do? What are you going to tell us about the economy? What would you tell them?
Oh, well, I'm not sure what you're asking. You mean what would I recommend they do?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, they're going to have to make hard choices that are not popular. So I think we need our politicians to make decisions that are best for the long-term health of the country, whether they get reelected or not. They just cannot be worried about their reelection at all. And there are politicians in Washington who are there to make that happen. For instance, our congressman from here in North Alabama, Mo Brooks, he is doing his duty as a citizen to go bring back fiscal responsibility.
Yep. Ron Paul's another who has said if he doesn't get the nomination for the Republican presidency, he's not going to run for reelection as a Texas congressman. But he too is, you know, I think he knows where the pulse is, and he's got his finger on it.
Yeah, the politicians have got to start working for the public. And stop lording it over the rest of us, you know, realizing that they're the public servants and they're the ones that are supposed to be doing what's best for the country, not what's best for them. Because, you know, you've seen the statistics of congressmen and senators that have been in office for a while. How is it that they end up becoming so wealthy in such a short period of time?
Yeah.
You know, doing what they do.
Well, and I was reading that Bill Clinton has made millions and millions of dollars in speeches since he was president. Millions. It's amazing. But, you know, Roy, we both agree this is the greatest country on this planet. It is so benevolent. We are there to help other countries in need. We're still giving aid to other countries when we're ready to go down the tubes. We've got to fix it because this is too precious a country to let it spoil and rot.
Oh, I agree. I think we're the greatest hope. We're the beacon of light for freedom for the world, and freedom is what is required for prosperity anywhere in the world.
Part of me thinks this one world government group out there really wants to see this all happen. I mean, not only through tragedies and things that have occurred over the years, but now economically the big boy gets knocked off his perch. And now they make it an even playing field. I don't. There's a part of me that believes that. What about you?
10 years ago, I would have said no. Now I'm increasingly convinced that you're correct, George. I think that generally speaking, you know, whether you're talking about one world government or just politicians in our government, remember their reason for living is to have power. And to the extent that people are more dependent on the government for handouts, the more power they have, the more reason they have to exist. But, you know, the greater the reason there is for them to go to work each day. So if it even gets to the point where the economy is hurting, that means more people are dependent on government or on their fellow people.
Absolutely. You know? Roy, stay with us. We're going to come back for an hour of phone calls with you as we talk about climate change and Fundonomics as well. I saw a picture yesterday, a nighttime skyline picture of Hong Kong. And I got to tell you, it looks like I was looking at a city from the year 2500. It looked that sophisticated. Back in a moment with your phone calls. with Dr. Roy Spencer on Coast to Coast AM.